Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting Scripture Through the Ages. Our guest is Ron Eldred, who teaches Scripture and History at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the street. We have just finished on our last session about David Friedrich Strauss. So, Ron, perhaps we could just pick up a little bit about David Friedrich Strauss. And I think you had a disturbing experience from reading one of his books personally when you were a young man. Maybe you can recount that for us, too, because personal experiences carry so much weight.
Yes, I won't tell the whole story, but since I told it the last session, but when I was in the Air Force, this would have been 1957. I went in 55, but this was a couple of years later. I was stationed in California at the time, and I was taking the train out to Los Angeles from Terre Haute, and the train stopped over in St. Louis. And I went into the train station there and went to the paperback book section and pulled out a paperback there that was called The Life of Christ and The Life of Jesus. And, I thought, well, that's a good book to read. So on the way out there, I read the book, or at least about half of it. And basically, from the time I got from St. Louis to Los Angeles, I pretty well lost my faith.
Wow.
Now, I was only young. I was probably 19, maybe 20 at the time, and pretty ignorant about such things. And I'd largely been raised in a Protestant family, although there was a Catholic side of the family too. And, you know, they didn't really go into those kind of ways to try to understand any criticisms of the kind of things you find in that book. Because what Strauss does in his book is that he, as we've talked about some of these other German Lutheran scripture scholars, and he was a German Lutheran, Strauss basically tries to prove that all of the miracles and all of the supernatural kinds of things you find in the Bible were just simply a matter of mythology. That the Bible wasn't written until the end of the first century or maybe well into the second century, and so obviously it couldn't be written by eyewitnesses, and by that time there had been allowed enough time for myths or legends to kind of begin to develop about the stories about Jesus. And so he wasn't one of those that at least originally tried to explain away the miracles by a naturalistic explanation. We've looked at some of the scripture scholars who did do that. Basically, his approach was the mythological approach. And in other words, there were just myths developed in that year let's say 70 or 80 years, 100 years since the time of Christ. And, of course, I didn't know any better. I'm reading this book.
His miracles particularly were sort of mythology.
That's what he argued, yes, rather than that they were naturalistic events. Now, later on in his life, he did come out with another, a much smaller volume. And that's probably the one I read, because in that volume, it was more popular consumption. The first book he read was a very scholarly book. Actually, it was two volumes, if I remember right, first, in German, of course. And it was, of course, translated into French and English and other languages. But the volume I read was probably, as I said, a scaled-down version that was more for popular consumption. And he was beginning to integrate some of these ideas in there about naturalistic explanations. And I mean by naturalistic that Jesus didn't really walk on water, it was just a shallow part of the lake, or maybe there's some rocks sticking up, or he didn't really calm the waters, by telling the waters to quiet on the lake. The boat actually turned around into a little cove where it was quiet, that he didn't really multiply the loaves and fishes, that he appealed to people to open up their little knapsacks and share their lunches with everybody. And the whole book's that way.
Wow.
And here, you're a 20-year-old, you read that kind of thing, and you don't know any better, and it really does shake your
faith. Now, this was in The Life of Christ that you were reading?
Yes.
You picked up the paperback?
Of Strauss's, yes.
Okay, but that wasn't so much naturalistic as legendary.
Well, later on he did. As I said, the reason I'm thinking I probably had a later addition of it is that he did begin to integrate a little bit of that naturalistic explanation in this last volume he came out with before his death.
Okay.
So I have a feeling that's probably, it's been so long ago and I don't have the book. I haven't had it for years, so I can't say for sure. But like I said, I had no idea who Strauss was, that he was a, and that's what I'll say a little bit about here. We started talking about him the other day. He was born in about 1808, lived to about 1874. And as I said the other day, he studied to be a Protestant minister. He studied under F.C. Bauer, who we talked about a little bit in one of our sessions. And then he was a teacher. He became a teacher. He wrote that book that I'm talking about, at least the first edition he wrote, the two-volume edition, which was a very scholarly book with lots of footnotes in it. The book I read didn't have any footnotes in it, so it must have been that more popular version that he wrote, let's say, 20 years later in his life. And it's still, you can still buy it. It's still,
really?
It's still published, yes. So go to Amazon.com and type in Strauss, and you'll find the book is actually, there's several publishers.
Really?
That's still putting the book out. Rhonda Shervin and Eugene Kevin, they tell us in their Love of Wisdom, An Introduction to Christian Philosophy, that Strauss was one of the first to apply the hermeneutics of Benedict Spinoza to the New Testament by treating the supernatural aspects found in the Gospels as mythological. We spent quite a bit of time talking about Spinoza in the series we did called Understanding the Bible, and also in the series The Da Vinci Code. Spinoza came up quite a bit. Spinoza, you might recall, was a 17th century... he actually originally was Portuguese, but he was living in Holland at the time, and he was a Jewish person who actually had become, had fallen away from his Jewish faith, and he was always, of course, very anti-Christian because he felt like the Christians had persecuted the Jews over the years, and they had, you know, to some extent in Portugal. That's why his family left Portugal and went to Holland, and he had become basically, I think, an agnostic. I wouldn't say he was an atheist, but he certainly was an agnostic. And he developed really was what was a kind of a pantheistic religion, that all is one, all is God, that kind of notion that we've talked about a little bit in the series on the Da Vinci Code. But Spinoza, what he was trying to do in a book he called The Treatise of Something or Another, was to try to prove that what was in the Bible was just he tried to get naturalistic explanations for all of the miracles, all of the supernatural references in the New Testament especially. And what he was trying to do is use a system of questions, asking all kinds of questions, and questions that sometimes really don't have answers, or questions that biblical scholars really can't answer because there are no questions to it. But if you ask the question, that begins to sow the seeds of doubt. And the whole point is to sow the seed of doubt amongst Jewish people, sow the seed of doubt amongst Christians in the Bible, and then once you've done that, then you can kind of come in and develop a kind of religion of humanity, a humanitarian type of religion, a secular type of religion, and offer it to them, and try to get them to buy into that kind of religion. And really, that's kind of the technique, it seems like, that a lot of the modern scripture scholars and theologians are using. We'll get into that a little bit more when we get into some of the present-day scripture scholars in some of our later sessions. Shervin and Kevin, they inform us that he, quote them, quote, lost his boyhood Protestant religion in his studies of Kant, Hegel, and Schleiermacher when preparing for the Protestant ministry, end of quote. And we talked about all three of those at different times in this series. One scholar has said of Strauss that, quote, imbued with the philosophical prejudice of the Spinozan metaphysics against the free, sovereign, almighty, and personal God of creation and revelation, Strauss developed his analysis of the New Testament as the faith experience of Christ by an early credulous and myth-making community of believers. This Christ of faith has little in common with the Jesus of history. It was the substance of Strauss's Life of Christ, which Ernest Renan, which we'll spend a session on later, brought over into France for Catholic modernism. And end of quote. And as I said, we'll take a look at Renan and modernism in some of the later sessions.
Now, one of the reasons, Ron, we're talking about this is because this is very popular still today.
Oh, yes. This separation of the Christ of the Jesus of history from the Christ of faith. And as Pope Benedict XVI has told us in his one of his latest books called The Life of Christ, or The Life of Jesus, they're one and the same, that there is really no separation between the two, and that's one of the things we're trying to prove in this series.
If you could repeat that again, I think that's a good summary of what we've been talking about. What does the New Testament faith experience come up with? It's right, you had just mentioned it. It was an early, credulous, and myth-making community. In other words, the early Christians developed these legends and myths about Jesus and wrote them down in the New Testament?
Yeah, the whole issue is that there is the Jesus of history.
Okay.
He's the Jesus that actually existed. He's the Jesus that actually walked the face of the earth and taught and, you know, and preached and allegedly performed miracles and made various kinds of claims to divinity and things of that sort. But to these scripture scholars that we've been talking about, these German liberal, you know, Lutheran scripture scholars of the 1830s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and then later on, some even Catholics get into this by the end of the 19th century, and we haven't gotten to them yet, Loisy and Tyrrell and some of those, they basically believe that there was that real Jesus, but the Jesus you read about in the New Testament is not the real Jesus. That the New Testament wasn't written until maybe the late 1st century or into the early 2nd century or even up to the mid-2nd century. And it was not written by eyewitnesses. It couldn't have been, you know, that much later. And it was written by people who had come to believe, at least, that the resurrection really happened. Had come to believe that Jesus had performed these miracles. It gotten to be kind of mythological or kind of legendary for them, and so these scriptures—that's the so-called Christ of faith, the Christ of faith, in the Gospels we read about the Christ of faith. We don't read about the Jesus of history,
okay.
The real Jesus, who really wasn't divine. He was just a man, a special man, and all that kind of thing.
And so you're saying that's what recently Benedict XVI wrote about. And what was the name of it? Life of Christ? Or
Jesus of Nazareth.
Jesus
of
Nazareth.
The title of it, yes.
And he tackles that very thing.
Oh, yes.
That the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith really are the same person.
Yes, when you read the Gospels and you read about these miracles, when you read about these claims that Jesus made, that's the real Jesus.
Okay.
And that's what Benedict is saying, and that's what the Church, of course, has always taught. This is not just a Christ of faith that the later church had, let's say, another generation or two later, and sort of, quote, basically kind of made it up to fit their own needs, their own desires, their own hopes, and things of that sort.
And
we'll be more specific about this.
When we get into the Jesus seminar, we'll be into that very type of thing.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's go on. Be a little more specific, if you can, about what Strauss said in his Life of Christ. That was a paperback that you picked up on the train station, that made you lose your faith. Did you actually lose it for a while or almost lost it?
Well, almost.
Now, you weren't Catholic yet.
No. It was about, that was the summer of 1957. I was going to a new base. I was on that base.
You were in the Air Force?
Okay. I was on that base for a year. And then after that, I shipped out and went to Alaska. And I was up there a year. And it happened to be when I was in Alaska that the barracks I was in, about a block away, there was a little Catholic chapel. And two of my best friends in the outfit that I was in went to that church. In fact, they were both altar servers for the two priests, the three priests, actually, that worked in that particular chapel, served that particular chapel. So I started going there to Mass, and they had some Knights of Columbus books in the front that explained the Catholic faith, and I started getting these free Catholic booklets. They were, you know, they were everywhere from 25 to 30 pages long, And I said, well, this is the first time, you know, religion's really starting to make some sense. And then there was a book in the back, and it had a little library in the back. And you could check a book out, you know. And one of the first books I reached in and got was a book by a lady by the name of Ruth Cranston. And she it was about Lourdes. And she was actually a Protestant. And I read that book, and it was about the medical commission that the Lourdes had set up many years ago, and she tells the history of that. And it goes through all, I don't know, 60 or 70 miracles that have been declared miracles by the church of healings that had taken place at Lourdes. And, of course, when we had our series on Catholic apologetics, reasons to believe, you remember we call those motives of credibility.
Right.
That kind of miracles and prophecies that come true, that kind of thing feeds our intellect. And then we can, ponder it in our intellect and say, gosh, you know, that makes a lot of sense. That sounds, well that's awful powerful argument, you know, for the truth of Christianity and for the truth of that God exists and for the truth of the Catholic Church. Because all these took place within the Catholic Church in a very religious context. All these miracles took place. They were instantaneous healings of very, very serious diseases that took place while a person was, as the Blessed Sacrament was passing by, or as they were being bathed in the waters at Lourdes and things of that sort. And, you know, as I said, that's a very powerful motive of credibility. It's God's way of saying, hey, all this message that comes out of here, is really true. It's his way of kind of putting his stamp of approval on it.
Okay, so that there are miracles even happening today at a place like Lourdes, so if they could happen there, scientifically authenticated, they certainly could have happened in Jesus' time.
Sure.
But again, as you mentioned before, and I just run into this recently, but Christ of Faith people are trying to say that often that Jesus did cures by psychologically convincing the people that they really didn't have a demon, or they had a demon, but he really didn't, but he performed some kind of magic over them, and they thought they had been delivered. All kind of strange psychological explanations of Jesus' miracles.
Yeah, we would call these psychosomatic today, that they would argue, oh, these people just had psychosomatic illnesses, and so Jesus, you know, was able to work some kind of psychological voodoo on him, I guess, or something like that. He cured people that had leprosy. And leprosy is certainly not a psychological, psychosomatic illness. Or people who were blind and things of that sort. And the people that cured at Lourdes, for example, instantaneously are people who have cancer. They've had tuberculosis in its last stages. Really terrible, terrible people. People really on their deathbed, literally, lots of times. And just in a matter of seconds, they'd be up and completely healed, and going in to eat breakfast or lunch or whatever. And people who hadn't eaten sometimes, some of them hadn't eaten for maybe months or years because of the seriousness of their condition.
So, could you be more specific about what David Strauss said in his Life of Christ that made you lose your faith for a while?
Well, he explained every miracle of the Bible in mythological terms rather than in supernaturalistic terms or naturalistic terms. And I was too young and ignorant at the time to know any better. According to Philip Trower, and we've quoted Trower on several occasions in this series, Strauss, quote, acknowledged that there had been before him two different kinds of attempts to interpret the meaning of Jesus. The orthodox or supernatural approach started with the premise that all the scripture contained was true. That's the supernatural explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And by that we mean, of course, miracles and prophecies. And from this starting point, it explained the meaning of the various books, copying it best it could with whatever apparent contradictions it met. Then he goes on to say, quote, this is Trier now, quote, the natural or rational approach began with the opposite premise. Only what was historical or rationally explicable could possibly be true. Hence, only those passages allowed of rational explanation were to be considered as true. All else was to be eliminated. End of quote. And the rationalist, according to Strauss, as Trower's relating, you know, Strauss's way of thinking.
Okay.
The rationalists tried to correct the supernaturalists by claiming a number of things here. Jesus didn't walk on water, for example, but instead merely walked along the beach or on some shallow portion of the lake. Or number two, he didn't multiply the loaves and fishes, but got the crowd to share their lunches with others. Or he didn't cure the blind and deaf, but he used special water and powder formulas.
Mm.
That he didn't cure other diseases, but which were due to psychological factors anyway, but merely suggested in a clinical manner a cure, kind of a psychological cure.
Okay.
That he didn't die on the cross, but merely pretended to be dead.
That's about the most extreme one I've heard.
Well, you still hear those things. Mm-hmm. You'll still hear those things.
They're in some novels.
Yes. Although rationalists believe that the supernaturalist claims of Christianity had been demolished by Strauss and other liberal Protestant biblical scholars, these and many other rationalist claims can be, I think, easily refuted. But we'll save that for another totally different series when we go into what's actually in the Bible. And right now we're just looking at how it's interpreted historically. Trower says that Strauss found both of these approaches unsatisfactory. In other words, he didn't like the supernaturalist or the naturalist. So instead he proposed, in typically Hegelian fashion, a third method of interpretation, the mythological one, which would achieve a synthesis or combination of the acceptable elements of the two prior types of explanation. And on this matter, one scholar has said that, quote, having rejected both rationalist and supernaturalist approaches, Strauss then argues for a mythological one. And I think that I can best explain specifically what in Strauss's Life of Jesus has disturbed my faith by looking at what Marcus Borg has to say about him. And he should know, because he lost his faith by reading such books as a young man, that I did. And although he is considered one of the top experts on the life of Jesus today, he really never fully regained his Orthodox faith like I was able to do after having read some of those type of books. And Strauss, I think, was one of them, if I remember right. He's not only one of the most well-known experts on Strauss's life, but a leading practitioner of his method. He's a prominent member of the famous or infamous Jesus Seminar, and which has done so much to undermine and destroy people's faith by providing naturalistic explanations of Jesus' life and deeds in our present time, and for the at least for the last 15, 20 years. And he says that, quote, what made Strauss's book, now I'm quoting from Borg here, so controversial was his treatment of much of the Gospels, especially the miraculous elements, as mythical in character. To appreciate his contribution, we must set his argument in the context of the theological and biblical controversies of his day, end of quote.
Okay, well then, what were the controversies of his day that are necessary for us to understand Strauss's interpretation of the Gospels in a mythological way?
Well, Borg tells us that, and I'll quote from him a little bit here. This is an article he wrote about Strauss. In the decades prior to Strauss, theologians, scholars, and church people were struggling with the impact of the Enlightenment upon the Bible. We've already looked at that in some earlier series. Getting back to the quote, much of the struggle concerned how to understand stories of the miraculous, end of quote. And then Borg identifies two major positions that warred with each other, the rationalist, which I just call the naturalist, and the supernaturalist. He says that rationalist, this is quoting him again in this article, rationalist scholars, many of them were deist, claimed that violations of the laws of nature were impossible, that miracles could not happen, and hence sought a natural explanation of the miracle text in the Bible. He goes on to write, interestingly, the rationalists accepted an historical basis for the miracle stories in the Gospels, but denied that miraculous causation was involved. For example, they affirmed that the disciples really thought they saw Jesus walking on the water, but in fact he was walking on a row of submerged rocks just below the surface of the water. Similarly, the disciples thought that Jesus stilled a storm on the Sea of Galilee, but really, what really happened is that the boat in which they were traveling rounded a headland, which cut off the wind just as Jesus said, "Peace, be still." These are among the type of interpretations of Jesus' miracles that disturbed me so much when I was a young man. But I'll soon point out, Strauss explained away every one of Jesus' miracles in a different manner, in a very similar manner.
Okay.
And on the other hand, Borg maintains that, let me quote him one more time, quote, supernaturalist, defending not only the historical accuracy of the biblical accounts, but also the element of direct divine causation. For them, the miracles were exactly what they appeared to be, divine interventions into the natural order, end of quote. But Strauss disagreed with both naturalistic and supernaturalistic approaches and argued for a third approach, and that's the mythological. But his conclusions were almost the same as that of the naturalist.
Okay, I was going to say, it seems a little hard to differentiate the explanations of the naturalist, like rounding the head into a cove to cut off the wind when Jesus said, peace, be still, and what's mythological. So,
well, of the three approaches, to make sure this is clear, the supernatural explanation is what it says in the Bible really happened. That's the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith are one and the same. These things really happen. What the naturalist explanation or the rationalist explanation is that these were explained away in a naturalistic way. That there was nothing supernatural about it at all. They rounded, went into a cove and then the wind didn't blow anymore and the water was still in the cove.
Yeah.
Or that Jesus was walking along the shore, or walking in a shallow part of the lake. Those are naturalistic explanations for what people thought were supernatural.
Okay.
That's what Strauss was rejecting. He was rejecting both of those approaches.
Okay.
His approach was a little different. His approach is this mythological approach. That the Gospels were not written until about a century later, maybe, certainly maybe 70 or 80 years. In other words, at least it wasn't written by eyewitnesses.
Okay.
And it was written by a later generation of Christians. And this later generation of Christians had taken earlier stories of Jesus and embellished them.
All right.
For various reasons. In other words, they sort of began to develop legends or myths.
Okay.
And so this is, Strauss is different. Now, they really believed them.
Okay.
It wasn't that they were lying, the people who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It wasn't that they were lying, that they actually had come to believe that after about a century. It was the needs of the time.
Okay.
They had come to believe that Jesus had indeed risen from the dead, and that there was hope and all that kind of thing. And another life and stuff like that.
So that's why they were writing it, because they really believed it.
Yes.
Strauss calls it mythological.
He said it's mythological, that's okay. Really the Christ of faith. It's not the real Jesus that didn't do all those things, really. They had just simply come to believe that he had done these things.
Okay, Jesus of history and Christ of faith, we've been talking about, our time has run out. We say to our listening audience, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.